Thank you, Alessandra, and thank you all for coming here to this meeting. I mean, it's a real privilege to be able to discuss research and share ideas with such a diverse set of experts from different disciplines. So I've been looking forward to this for a while, in part because, as many speakers have noted already, it's a bit of a challenge to speak to an interdisciplinary audience, and like many before me, I'm going to focus on my own background, a social psychological background, and the work that I've done in that context. But at the same time, I'm going to try to sift through all the ideas I've been accumulating through all the talks and just try to stay on track as much as possible and focus on one particular theme, which you'll see highlighted here. Now, a few people earlier today and yesterday referred to work that Jeff Haddock and I have done on attitudes. This is a shameful plug of a recent textbook, which is going to the third edition, soon on sale near you. And in this work on attitudes, we've discussed many ways in which attitudes are relevant to the topic of intellectual humility. There are diverse ways in which I think attitudes are relevant. So there's work on persuasion, which Ulrika mentioned earlier today, and I'll come back to that shortly. There's work on attitude strength, attitude function. But actually, today I don't want to focus on attitudes per se. I'll say a bit about attitude function. But instead, as Alessandra mentioned, I'm going to focus more on values. Here's another shameful book plug. Now, the reason why I want to focus on values actually stems back to my undergraduate days. One of the reasons that I got interested in social psychology in the first place was a course I took in my third year of my combined psychology and sciences studies undergraduate degree, where I had a social psychology course, and part of that course was about attitudes, and in some of the readings, it became clear that attitudes were really interesting for the ways they connect to different behaviors, but also I was interested in the way there had been a historical turn in research on attitudes over the decades. So in early research on attitudes, people were very interested in very abstract attitudes. They were interested in attitudes toward different social groups, toward different ideals, different policies. And gradually there became a shift toward more pragmatic, specific, narrow attitudes. I say pragmatic partly because in order to study attitudes, it became easier to deal with them if we could just make them a bit more concrete and specific. But I remain fascinated in these abstract attitudes, the ones toward very broad ideas. And really that brought my interest to the topic of human values, because I think of human values as being like attitudes in many respects. They're emotional, they're cognitive, they have behavioral components, but they're also prescriptive. They include goals, they include your motives. So when we talk about human values, we talk about abstract ideals that are important to people as guiding principles in their lives. So they have a prescriptive element, they're fairly abstract, but they involve tendencies to evaluate these ideals with a degree of favorability. And incidentally, the tendency to evaluate with favor or disfavor is a core ingredient of attitudes. So basically, I migrate that interest over to values to a great degree. Wrong button. So let me be more concrete about values. So this is a former Prime Minister, David Cameron, who when taking office in number 10 Downing Street said that his government would be built on some clear values, values of freedom, values of fairness, and values of responsibility. His successor, Theresa May, went on to say, I want to set our party on in our country on a path built on values of fairness and opportunity. Now, I've given talks before, years back, where I was able to put in quotes from labor leaders upon taking office in number 10. Everyone who seems to go into number 10 immediately talks about values. In fact, I tried to find quotes from Donald Trump just to be international facing here. I couldn't find any. Honestly, it's the first time I've ever not been able to see something directly referring to values. I think this is very interesting to me. But anyway, these examples help to exemplify what we mean by values in contemporary psychological research on values. But I could go further. It's not just politicians who talk about them. The government, the UK Civil Service, talks about its core values. There are third sector organizations, like I think this is National Trust, which isolates particular abstract ideals that are important to them. Retail groups or companies, other third sector research groups talk about things like accountability, teamwork. They all invent their terms. And I was surprised. I tried to find the most counterintuitive example I could, and I thought, I know, I'll look for divorce lawyers who talk about values. And they do. There's like on a webpage where they have particular abstract ideals that are important as a regulatory framework. So in contemporary psychological research, when we try to measure values, you can do this at a group level, a broader collective identity level, or an individual level, but typically we focus on individuals. We ask individuals, to what extent are these ideals important to you as a guiding principle in your life? These are just some examples of abstract ideals that are given to people. So they include concepts like forgiveness, willing to pardon others, an exciting life, stimulating experiences. These parenthetic definitions are just meant to help clarify or elucidate the abstract terms. Now, I said these are just examples. The most popular contemporary model of values is one that has many different ideals. It gives these different abstract ideals often in one version of the measure in a list. People are asked to go through the entire list, think about which values are more important to them, which values are less important to them, which ones are in the middle, and then to go through and do their ratings. Because the stress in the measurement techniques is on relative differences between the importance of the different abstract ideals. Because they're pre-selected to be important to people on average. So the key measurement output from these measures is the relative differences. And there are different ways of calculating this. But from the perspective of the person completing the questionnaire, what's important is they go through and think about which ones are more important or less important to them, and then to provide the ratings on the scales. Some people might be familiar with an older measure of values by Milton Rokic, which tried to be very explicit in separating values by getting people to rank values in terms of their importance to them, so really forcing these differences. But it turns out, psychometrically, you don't need to force people to rank. You can just encourage differentiation and you'll get differences. So in research on values, the reason why that model, this model by Shalom Schwartz is shown here, is so widespread and used a lot is because it's been tested in over 80 different nations. It's been cited something like more than, a work using this model has been cited now something like more than 40,000 times. It's become very prevalent, in part because it makes some clear predictions about patterns of relations between the importance of values as guiding principles. This model shows the abstract ideals in terms of their motivational interrelations. So Schwartz's assumption is that the abstract ideals we consider important serve or to express different motives. This is something that is actually an idea that comes up within literature on attitude function as well, the idea that many different attitudes we have also express different motives. In the context of values, what Schwartz is trying to do is say, at this abstract level, there are particular motivational tensions between different abstract ideals. So for instance, we have some values like tolerance or concern benevolence values at the top here, which involve transcending one's personal interests to consider the well-being of others. Schwartz proposes that that tends to be at odds or with motivational conflict with values like power or achievement or hedonism, which tend to put the self first, okay, and look for promoting one's own interests. So people who consider these values to be highly important will tend to, on average, consider these values to be less important. And if you go to this bottom left portion of the circle where you see security and conformity values, people who consider these values to be important will tend to consider the opposing domain, stimulation, self-direction type values, to be less important. So you see oppositions or negative relations across the model. Oh, and incidentally, if you are looking at ratings that are adjacent within the model, you tend to see positive correlations. So security values as being very important tend to rate tradition values as being very important as an example. Now, that model, I mean, the details of these motivational conflicts aren't too important for the talk today. The reason why I go over this model is because of its potential implications for some of the processes we've been talking about. And in particular, what I'm going to focus on is the role of what we call self-affirmation in the literature on social psychology and its connection to openness to change or open-mindedness. Now, there are many ways in which I think values could be connected to open-mindedness. And the reason why I'm focusing on self-affirmation is actually just due to time, just to try to be concise about and focus. And in part, too, because self-affirmation is central to the outline sketch of a study that Alessandra and I proposed in the project that led to this meeting. So I'd like to give you, in the final stage of this presentation, an outline sketch of this study and describe how self-affirmation is related. But before then, I need to describe self-affirmation and discuss three ways in which I think values may be playing a role within self-affirmation tasks, among others. So, within self-affirmation tasks, people are often, and not always, this is only about half the self-affirmation interventions, but people are often asked to, as Steve described earlier today, to look at a list of values, select one that is the most important to them from that list, and then write a few paragraphs about why the value is important to them, or perhaps some other rating scales related to that value. So it's a task that involves identifying an ideal that is very central to the self, and then also elaborating on reasons for the importance of that ideal. Now, there's a long background to why this task might be interesting to do. In research on self-affirmation processes and self-affirmation theory, this task has led to a plethora of different effects. So, as you can see summarized here, people who complete this task are more likely to accept counter-attitudinal arguments on political topics relative to control conditions. One example control condition, as Steve mentioned, was to talk about an unimportant. Regardless of which precise paradigm is used, we also see there's increased responsiveness to persuasive messages about threatening health risks. There's also lower discrimination against outgroups after a self-affirmation task, more achievement in threatening conditions. These are conditions that usually raise a stereotype threat in many of the recent experiments, so citing a stereotype that might imply lower achievement for the groups of participants involved. Also, there's recent evidence of heightened well-being following self-affirmation tasks, more likelihood of apologizing to transgressors. And recently, there's some work on actual perceptual changes that we've had, which is a little bit disconnected from what I'll talk about today. But my point is that there is a diversity of effects of self-affirmation. Now, what binds them? What's in common here across all of these effects? Well, I've seen a variety of discussions of this, but the thing that comes up most often is Todd Steele's initial reference to self-integrity as being crucial to self-affirmation efforts. So when we complete a value affirmation exercise, in theory, what it's doing is it's reminding us or boosting our sense of self-integrity at the time. So we remember something, a core ideal that's very important to us, and it reminds us of a cherished aspect of ourselves, which can boost our faith in our own integrity. Now, by boosting this faith in our own integrity, in theory, what it does is it potentially diminishes the sense of threat that we might get from other stimuli that are presented. So other potentially threatening stimuli no longer seem quite as threatening, or if they are threatening in some way, we're not too concerned about that threat because we've just affirmed a core aspect of ourselves, so we're better prepared, we have more resource to deal with it. Okay, so So we're more open-minded in the face of those threats because we feel like we're dealing from a stronger position. So this is part of the reason why I like to focus, in fact, on self-affirmation, because over the last 2 days, we've heard a lot about epistemic validity in open-mindedness, but we've also heard a lot about the importance of the self and the importance of ego defense and trying to distance self-motives and self-protection concerns from actual judgments in contexts where people might be having dialogue over contentious issues. So this process could be a potentially important tool for understanding ways to increase open-mindedness. So one of my favorite studies in this area is one led by Joshua Correll and colleagues, including Steve. And it's one about 2004, so 13 years ago, published, where what they did was they looked at the effects of different persuasive messages that were pre-designed to be relatively strong or weak in argument quality. Now, I think, incidentally, Ulrika makes some very important points about argument quality earlier today, and I take those points and think they're very important. But in research like this, and the research that I'll describe shortly, our key concern is about people's responsiveness to arguments that have been preset to be strong or weak, not what makes them strong or weak in the first place, which I think is an important issue. But the key for now in the self-affirmation process is to understand when do people respond to strong and weak arguments differently. So in this study, what they did was they gave people strong or weak arguments in favor of tuition fees. These were students, I believe undergraduate students, watching a videotape of some other students in the video arguing for or against increased tuition fees. And the arguments were either strong or weak. And what was really nice about this study is that the participants had, it was some sort of wristwatch or something.
It's just a little
Little dial to show how persuasive each claim was as the speakers were talking. And so they tracked the persuasiveness of each claim as this is going on. But some participants beforehand had done a value affirmation task and others had not. And what you can see in this graph is that participants who had done the value affirmation task were more sensitive to the strength of the arguments and the rating of the persuasive. People who had not been affirmed did not differentiate the two, the pre-tested strong versus weak arguments. Now, I don't recall the exact examples of the arguments in this case, but in my prior experience using arguments like this, the weak arguments are really weak. I mean, they're things that you really should notice if you've been reading as being weak. So they would say things like, you should have increased tuition fees because graduate students pay a lot of money and undergrads do too. So it's the type of thing where you really expect they would pick this up. And whereas the strong arguments would be more about things like employability or personal stakes, that might be important. So you want people to detect these differences. If they are processing in a relatively thorough and unbiased way. So I mentioned that study partly because that's going to be relevant later. Partly because it helps to illustrate value affirmation, the design of that task itself. As I've indicated, there are ubiquitous effects of self-affirmation tasks, and it decreases defensiveness and increases information scrutiny. But the key question I want to ask now is, what is the role of values in this process? Because the process itself might involve affirmation. Self-integrity, as we've discussed. But we're using values within this task. And as I've just described, Schwartz's model of values describes a diversity of values with different motivational interrelations. And I think there could be potential consequences of thinking about those motives. Now, prior research has alluded to a number of ways in which values might play a role. So I'm going to just discuss three which leap out to me. One is role potentially in increasing respect for others, that the values that are considered might increase our communal focus. A second route is potentially involved increasing our protection of the values, per se. And a third flexibility involves decreasing the protection of the value. So you're not reading wrong. I'm actually saying there are two possibilities, two possible consequences of thinking about values that could occur through this paradigm. And the relative balance of each one might be crucial to what happens. Okay, so many people have observed that through values affirmation tasks, there is often a reference in people's writing to increased connectedness to other people. So when you look at the values that people select and how they write about them, they often end up talking about impacts that the values have on others, impacts that the pursuit of these values have on relations with others. So you could think about equality, for example, and automatically it makes people think about interrelations between groups, harms that might befall other groups if they're treated badly, etc. So it's been noted that there is that theme. And in Jennifer Crocker's paper here, they actually do have a couple of studies where they measure the extent of the feeling of connectedness to others as a function of the task, and find that when they rated the degree of self-transcendence from the value affirmation, that this predicted the strength of the value affirmation effect on reduced defensiveness later on, more than their own ratings of self-integrity. So they had to, they also tried to assess self-integrity, but they found that it was the feeling of self-transcendence, so that was a crucial mediator. So that suggests that feelings of connectedness to others is important as a factor in mediating the effects of self-affirmation. But right away I'm a bit puzzled by this, because that would also suggest that for the effect to work, that we really need to only be thinking of these types of values, because these really focus on connections to others. But in that paper, there wasn't an effect that was pronounced for one set of values over other values. It didn't matter which values people were writing about. What mattered was how they were writing about them and whether it emphasized the sense of connectedness to others. But if we go around the model, we could say, well, potentially that could also entail these models, these values, sorry. And notice humility right here. The circles haven't quite landed right. But there's also a value of humility within Schwartz's model. That would seem particularly relevant to lower defensiveness. But again, I've not seen any evidence yet that there's any special status from thinking about that particular set of values as opposed to these. But it would seem particularly problematic if people were to focus on these values, okay, the self-enhancement values, because shouldn't that diminish a sense of connectedness to others? Now, the only reason, as I say, I go through this is to point out that if we integrate, if we think deeply about values in this context, we can see that potentially there are some nuances in the way that values affirmation should work. And the last thought could be, for example, openness to change values, where you think thinking about those values should be pretty good for increasing open-mindedness, right? Because that's what those values are all about. But I'm not aware of any evidence yet to that effect. But I think it's a good open question. Nonetheless, I put this kind of check mark there beside increasing respect for others, because we might say that to this point there is provocative evidence to suggest that one aspect of this task may entail increasing thoughtfulness about other people. Okay, so how exactly that happens and when that happens may still be worth exploring, but one aspect of it may entail thinking about others. So this second route, protection. Wow, that was fast. Okay, I'm going to have to do it quickly. So the second route, protection of one's own values. Well, here we come back to the attitude functions work. So if we think about Brexit, in a lot of the debate about Brexit, there were the Remainers happened to be focusing on economic consequences of Brexit. The Leavers often focused on values, ironically, autonomy, self-direction, stimulation. And later, people suggested that this might have been this might have explained some of the outcome, in the sense that by focusing on values, Leavers might have been resonating with the public to a stronger degree, or at least getting them to devote themselves to a particular stance more strongly by echoing the values. Anyway, whether that's true or not, it doesn't matter to me for this purpose. my point is that at the attitude function is about knowing what is the motivational basis for an attitude in the first place. So it could be based on your values, trying to express those values, or it could potentially be on utilitarian concerns, like what are the costs and benefits for me of Brexit. Well, the reason why that's important partly is because, as I just hinted, there's a lot of research suggesting that when people tie values to specific attitudes like Brexit, they tend to be more resistant to persuasive attacks. So if you give people messages on value-expressive attitude topics, they're very difficult to nudge, very difficult to move in general, compared to if it was more utilitarian concerns. Now, that was based on a meta-analysis, which was actually a bit contentious, looking at research over a few decades. Shortly after this, Jim Olson and I, decided to do a study where we actually manipulate the basis of people's attitudes and tried to test whether or not, looking at the same attitude topic, we could see that making an attitude value expressive or utilitarian would have an effect on open-mindedness. And the reason why we did that is because the contentious aspect of the prior research had to do with how different topics were used for value-expressive attitudes research and research that was focusing on utilitarian outcomes. So if you're looking at different topics, then there are a variety of different ways in which attitudes toward those topics might be confounded. What we did was we gave people an academic issue, implementing comprehensive exams. We asked the students about their attitudes toward having comprehensive exams after giving them a persuasive message arguing in favor of it. Again, either strong or weak arguments. But beforehand, we gave them tasks that encouraged them to link values like freedom and autonomy to their attitudes toward things like coursework in their programs. Or we asked them to think about the costs and benefits for their time and energy with regard to things like coursework. Then we gave them the comprehensive exam messages, and what we found was that after having had practice forming value-expressive attitudes toward academic demands, they were much less sensitive to the argument strength for these new exam requirements that we were presenting compared to people who had practiced forming utilitarian-based attitudes toward these academic demands. So thinking about something, getting practice, thinking about an attitude in terms of values, decreased open-mindedness from this perspective compared to thinking about it in terms of utilitarian consequences. So I mention this because in self-affirmation designs where values are thought about, in theory this could give people practice at forming or thinking about values and forming value-expressive attitudes. So depending on how it's done, it could be that people soon after a self-affirmation task start thinking about their subsequent attitudes in a way that might express their values. Now, in fact, many people who use self-affirmation designs then comment and say that they select subsequent topics in a way that they hope will not be directly relevant to the values that were used in the prior self-affirmation task. So they're aware of this and try to avoid having any connection between the values affirmation and the subsequent topic. I think partly just to avoid this problem of having value-expressive attitudes that are resistant to change. So that's fair enough. But I think it still means that to understand the effects of value affirmation, we have to keep this in mind, that there is the potential that you don't get more open-mindedness, you get more resistance as a function of practicing forming a value-expressive attitude. And then the last thing, which I'm going to go through quickly, is actually to turn this on its head a bit. And this is an idea that goes back a number of decades. So William McGuire, one of my favorite social psychologists, talked about truisms. He studied truisms and the idea of, this is the idea that there are many beliefs that are so widespread, so consensually accepted that we just take them for granted and don't bother to build cognitive support for them. And the reason why he was interested in truisms was because he thought that they were very vulnerable to persuasive attack. They're like paper tigers. So as soon as you tell people that brushing your teeth several times each day actually damages enamel and is bad for your dental health, they might actually change their endorsements of this quite a lot because they haven't thought about it before, if it's a truism. And he did many studies demonstrating,
great degree of attitude change after simple, persuasive messages confronting truisms.
He also proposed that many cherished beliefs like values are truisms, but never tested that, never directly tested it, because he thought we're so emotionally attached to our values, and they're such a part of our self-concept, that we'd resist these brief persuasive messages even if we had trouble defending them. But years later, Rokeek showed you could change values through a simple value self-confrontation paradigm, and we did research showing that a little three-page essay attacking the value of equality could get 30% movement on the response scale, the same response scale that McGuire had used in endorsements of equality. So we basically concluded that values have a truistic element to them, and that leaves them more vulnerable to change than you might think. Shortly after that, and I'm going to race through a bit, maybe not shortly, almost a decade after that, Kevin Blankenship and colleagues have looked at this finding and said that an interesting consequence of this is because values are susceptible to change, they might actually be a route to attitude change. So if an attitude is value expressive and you seek to defend it because of its expression of your core values, then potentially changing the values is an indirect way to changing the attitudes. And what they found was that they could change value-expressive attitudes more powerfully by directly attacking the value that was related to it than by attacking the attitudes themselves. So across a number of studies, they found that they could change the value, and not only change the particular target value attitude that was relevant to that value, but change other attitudes that were relevant to that value. So they argued that value change actually is a route to attitude change when the attitudes are value expressive, in a way of circumventing this resistance. So that brings me to that third route about decreasing protection of values. Because if you're introspecting about values in a values affirmation task, then not only are you potentially thinking about values in a way that might make subsequent attitudes more value expressive, but one other aspect of that task, which actually I didn't mention, it was on one of the prior slides, one other aspect of that task is it changes values. So in many prior experiments we've done, we've asked people to think about reasons for and against the value. And what we find over and over again is that people change the ratings of the values after doing that. They go up, they go down, but they change. The introspection makes them think about the values differently. So if you can get value change from this task, then that suggests you might get attitude change in the way that Blankenship and colleagues mentioned. So that brings me to this project, because essentially what we'd like to do is to apply a values affirmation task and to look at how it affects the real discussion and debate that occurs subsequently. So if we imagine this design that I showed you earlier, where you get arguments from another couple people on tuition fees, and they're strong or they're weak arguments, and you might be affirmed or not affirmed, we'd like to do that again with values, perhaps changing the values and the nature of the values that people think about, but also while having real discussion take place. So not only do people rate the persuasiveness of other people's arguments, but actually respond to those arguments. And in those responses, can we see whether or not they show more defensiveness, more open-mindedness? What are the conversational dynamics that apply in this context? And do those dynamics depend on which values they thought about or whether they've been affirmed in the first place? So as I said, that's just a sketch of the general idea. But the idea is that we can perhaps look at nonverbal defensiveness, verbal defensiveness, emotionality, variables like this, code all of these, and see how much value affirmation task influences them within an actual debate. Last thing very quickly that I want to stress is I focus on open-mindedness in a kind of epistemic point of view. And this is a recent scale looking at intellectual humility, which distinguishes between four different dimensions. The first one, independence of intellect and ego, is one that I think actually is most clearly relevant to the self-affirmation literature, because it's about, that scale is about seeing seeing an issue as being separate from the evaluation of yourself and your own intelligence. It's about being able to separate that from your evaluation of a particular topic. So that's supposed to be one important aspect of intellectual humility. Openness to revising a viewpoint because it might be incorrect is just another aspect. Respect for others' viewpoints in an interpersonal way is yet another aspect of intellectual humility. It's separate from epistemic validity, but it's more about just recognizing that other people have equal worth and value. And then finally, intellectual overconfidence is a bit about calibration of oneself versus others' skills. I just point that out because I've been focusing on number two, but I think that when you take the values from a thorough perspective, from you think about that whole model that I just showed you, you probably could see potential implications for each of these separately, not just the second route. Thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank the Templeton Foundation for sponsoring this. I'm sure we'll thank them again. I'd also like to thank Debbie and the UVAB lab at Bath.